Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Sauce Perspective, where today's theme is, if you have Marshawn Lynch on your football team, and there's 20 seconds left in the game, and you're on, like, the 2 or 3 yard line, maybe you should run the ball instead of passing it. I'm your host, Don Sauce, and this is my co-host, Trevor Sauce.
Going to reserve all my arguments and counterpoints to what you just made till that segment. I don't want to digress already.
All right, fair enough. Okay, well, Trevor, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how the Sauce Perspective is laid out?
Well, the Sauce Perspective is broken into 3 segments. The first segment, called Digging Deep, is where Don suggests a movie to watch. Oftentimes is underappreciated and or unknown. Often is the key word there. Second segment, this week's Hot Sauce, is where we discuss something new. That could be TV, music, movies, video games, culture event, such as today. And basically anything we want to talk about. And then lastly, well, this pop culture related, but no. And lastly is the secret sauce, where we just have an open conversation about everything else that we want to talk about that's on a chest. So what's on the talking board, I don't know why I said talking board, but what's on the top, what are we talking about today, Don? I'm just rambling now.
You were having trouble putting that sentence together, weren't you?
I was. I didn't know where I was going with that. I was just like, fail.
Fair enough. All right. Well, today begins our, what was originally going to be 10 weeks, but became 11 week, after I realized that I wanted to have us watch something before True Detective starts. And we're going to be doing this for like the next, you know, 2.5 months, basically. Our 11-week series of films starring actors and actresses either before they were famous or in the role that made them famous. And we're starting off with, you know, the current belle of the ball for major Hollywood films, Jennifer Lawrence, in the role that basically got her, you know, leading lady attention for the first time in her life with Winter's Bone, the 2010 film. For this week's Hot Sauce, we're going to be talking about, if you couldn't guess from my theme, the Super Bowl. And for the secret sauce, Trevor might talk a little bit about the pilot of The Man in the High Castle, as well as a new board game that he started out. And I haven't really done anything productive this weekend, or not this weekend, in the last week, besides work stuff. So I don't know how much I'll be able to contribute. Oh, I watched Boyhood.
Oh, I also watched Whiplash. I forgot about that.
Okay, well, there we go. But I don't want to talk about Boyhood, because it's definitely going to be a digging deep. So, like, I'm going to buy it the next time I buy a movie. I'll buy it in addition to the movie that I want to buy. And on that note, I suppose it is time for us to leap right into digging deep. And Trevor, did you think Winter's Bone is a good movie?
Well, I don't know how good your memory is, Don, but we actually had a brief discussion about this movie roughly over a year ago.
Oh, you're right. No, I do remember that.
Okay.
I don't remember what you thought about the film, other than that we briefly talked about it during The Secret Sauce, before The Secret Sauce had a name.
Yes, that was during that dark period of the podcast. Oh.
it would have had to have been like in probably the first month of the podcast's existence.
Yeah, because I went on the Jennifer Lawrence binge.
Right, we talked about J-Law like literally every week for like 5 weeks straight in some form or another.
Yes, I was able to drop her name in the podcast at some point. And then that kind of died off because, you know, well, I started, she doesn't have that many movies.
Right, she's not, you know, that 1 year where Jude Law was in like 8 movies.
I definitely enjoy Winter's Bone. And I think there's lots, and this is my second viewing, which tremendously helps when I talk about movies with you. It's my first viewing. It's like, I gotta digest everything. This time I don't have to digest it. I only knew what was coming, so I could experience it in a different perspective. I can pay attention to different things.
Second viewings are immensely helpful in critical analysis of a film. I'm skeptical, actually, of my ability to properly analyze a film with just a single viewing of it. I mean, I can do it, but I always feel like my insights are a lot better the second time I watch a movie, because I'm not just trying to follow the plot, I'm able to put everything together.
Exactly.
I mean, for example, when I review albums for Babel, I don't only listen to the album one time before I review it. It's a minimum of 3 listens before I could properly review an album, and it's interesting that I don't put the same kind of effort into, like, watching movies But, I mean, albums are maybe a more abstract experience than a film is, but I don't know.
And also, are easier. You can get through. You can listen to an album three times over before you can finish a three-hour movie, Don.
For sure. That's true. Okay, well, before we talk about our individual reactions to the film, then, because I had interesting, my perspective on the film shifted a lot on this viewing. For those of you who have never seen Winter's Bone, like I said, it's a 2010 film from director Deborah Granick, who is mostly has done documentaries, but this is a fiction film that she made. It was adapted from a book by an author named Danielle Woodrell. But it's about a young girl named Ree, who's about 17 years old, that lives in the Ozarks. I'm assuming Arkansas or Missouri. I'm guessing Missouri because of the song they play at the very, very beginning. And I just realized that she says she goes to the Arkansas state line at one point in the film. But it's about a young girl named Ree, who is basically taking care of her much, much younger little brother and little sister, as well as her mentally ill mother, in abject, crushing poverty. Her father, who's been in and out of jail her whole life, has apparently jumped bond, and if she's unable to find her father, the bonds people will repossess her home and all of her land, and her family will be homeless. And so J-Law, Ree, has no choice but to sort of delve into the rural criminal underground. The rural criminal underworld that her father has spent most of his life navigating. She's forced to navigate it herself to find him so that she and her family can be taken care of. All right, well, Trevor, what do you think about Winter's Bone?
Well, with my second viewing here, we talked briefly about this concept in the first time we mentioned this movie. But the second viewing, because I wasn't paying attention to what was actually happening as much, just the soul crushing reality of knowing, like, for the listeners that don't know us, this is basically what we're from.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up, because
you obviously, from our perspective, is just how accurate the reality is that they describe in this for poor royal families. It's so on the spot that it sickens me, like to know that, you know, I know people that live like this because they have to.
Right. So, I mean, for listeners who maybe want a little more context there, Trevor and I are from West Virginia, if you don't know us, and West Virginia is the second or third poorest state in the Union. And specifically, at least both of us spent our high school years in Barber County, West Virginia, and Barber County is one of the poorest states in West Virginia. So we're not one of the poorest states, one of the poorest counties in West Virginia. So we're from one of the poorest counties and one of the poorest states in the nation. And you don't see rural poverty very often in film. And on this viewing, because I knew what was going to happen, like you, I wasn't focusing too much on the narrative of Winter's Bone. And, I mean, I enjoy the narrative of Winter's Bone. It's a really interesting spin on noir. I mean, Winter's Bone is basically a noir film.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a private eye movie, but told from the perspective of a 17-year-old girl in the Ozarks instead of a white detective in Hollywood in the 1940s. And that's all really good, but what I mostly thought about when I was watching this film is just how authentic it feels. You can tell Hollywood movies from reality because everything is glamorized and people live in homes that they shouldn't be able to live in for the wages that they make, etc., etc. But Deborah Granick, and this is, you know, I guess where it comes in handy that I know a little bit about, like, the production of these films. Deborah Granick shot Winter's Bone in an actual, very impoverished rural Ozark community. She populated most of the film with non-professional actors. And as a matter of fact, in terms of actors and actresses in this film that I, immediately know, it's Jennifer Lawrence, it's Garrett Dillahunt, who plays the sheriff, it's John Hawks, who plays the uncle, Dale Dickey, who is the wife of the big bad of the film, and then also, weirdly, Laura Palmer from Twin Peaks has a small role. She's Ree's father's old mistress. But beyond, like, these, you know, some of the bigger roles in the film, everybody in this movie looks like they stepped out of the kinds of communities that Trevor and I grew up in. And it's because they did step out of the communities that they grew up in. And this film looks like it was shot in the communities that Trevor and I grew up in because it was shot in the communities that Trevor and I grew up in. And you can't fake authenticity. And so there's a term for sort of, you know, things like the set design and the general feel and look of a picture, like beyond like cinematography, and it's called mise-en-scène. And the mise-en-scène of Winter's Bone in terms of capturing just rural American poverty is unmatched for anything that's not a documentary. I mean, Trevor, you specifically, like, I didn't grow up in a community. I grew up on Route 57. So I grew up, you know, without having neighbors besides our grandparents in either direction for at least a mile. You, however, you know, you grew up in Century.
Yeah.
So I think you're probably even more familiar with this than I am.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, this is very common. In this, all these situations, these run-down houses, junk everywhere, trash is laying on the ground because there's no place to put it, you know. And it just makes me literally, like, stick to my stomach thinking about it because there is no other option for these people. Like, there's a great scene when she's going to the army recruiter, and that's literally how most of the people get out of that situation that we know.
Oh, yeah.
How many people that's do we know that joined the armed forces to literally leave?
Yeah, I mean, that's an underappreciated
element. That's what my dad
did.
He did that to get his education in the process, but that was an out for him.
Right, no, for sure. And I think that's an underappreciated moment in this film that people don't talk about enough. When people talk about Winter's Bone, they talk about the way that it authentically, in terms of visuals, the way that it is authentic in its portrayal of poverty. And they also talk about how great the performances are in it. But there's that crushing sense of you can't escape this that, you know, permeates these communities. And you and I have been very fortunate because we were able to get out of that because, you know, we had parents that made sacrifices so we could get out of there. And, you know, we were never, neither of us were ever this, you know, poor to begin with.
No, yeah, we were never like, yeah, we weren't in poverty. Like, we were managing.
Right.
We were capable of managing.
Yeah, we could get by, but we, you know, we totally knew people that couldn't get by. And even though, you know, you and I didn't come from this, that sense of, you know, you should, you know, learn to settle for this lot in life definitely permeated Philip Barber. There was like a spirit at PB, which is weird because I still think that we had one of the best graduating classes ever in terms of a variety of students with a diverse set of highly talented people. But there was this notion that, you know, why try and do better? This is okay. Fuck no, it's not okay. We should try and aspire for more. But when all you know is being poor, it's hard to look at the world that way.
Yeah, definitely when you're not part of a larger community also. Like, that's the biggest difference, I think, between rural poverty and city poverty. Is at least city poverty is in density area where there's other people and you can get a sense that there's something else out there. In rural poverty, there is nothing else out there. You're by yourself, basically,
yeah,
in that situation, and nothing's there to support you.
For sure. I mean, I just said this, but, like, so, you know, you always see urban poverty in film, and I get that because it's the most visible. It's hard to ignore, you know, Compton or the Baltimore projects when they're right next to, you know, Hollywood or, you know, Camden Yards, for example. You can't just, like, turn a blind eye to the fact that it exists. But rural poverty is so isolated.
Yep.
It's if you haven't been in that part of the country, you can't conceptualize it. Winter's Bone is probably the closest that you're ever going to get to understanding what it's like. I had a girlfriend, I mean, I had a girlfriend sophomore year of college, Trevor knows who I'm talking about, who came to my dad's place for winter break one year. And she had been to my mother's, too, for like a week or so before that. She stayed at my place for that holiday for various reasons. And this, you know, nice, like, almost gated suburban community that we were living in Preston County, because at the time my mom had a good house, because her at the time she had a good job and her ex-husband had a good job, and so they bought this place, and then
yeah, so she had a house in a development outside of the greater Morgantown area. Yes,
right,
that's what you're trying to get at. Got it.
Right. And then we came to Philippi.
Well, then you came to your dad's. I don't even call that Philippi.
Right. So Christine, the ex-girlfriend, was so confused by, like, she's like, you know, where are the lights? And, you know, where are the, why don't you have cell phone service? Why don't you have fast internet? It's hard to understand.
You can walk outside and hear crickets? What?
Yeah. You know, oh, I can see the entire night sky.
That's the
unabated
Milky Way
by
there?
Light pollution.
No way.
But it's hard to understand, like, how separated you are from the modern world if you haven't had a chance to go to these places. And I mean, my dad didn't get not dial up internet until 2011, I don't think. The winter of 2011, the, like, not early winter, like the November December time. So it's a whole new world, and it's not something that it doesn't get very much representation in cinema. And that's, I mean, it's a shame. One of the TV show that I really, really like, Justified, that I will get you to watch someday, it's also like Winter's Bone in that regard, in that it takes place in a rural, impoverished community. So it's very interesting to see that perspective. When I was living in New York City, Justified was having one of its, I think, its third season while I was there, and basically seeing Appalachia every week, and seeing towns that looked, you know, that were definitely bigger than Philippi, but could be Philippi someday if it had a big population boom. It was like seeing home again. Which, you know, I don't get homesick, but it was nice to have even that visual reminder of home. But now that we've harped on how authentic the film is, I want to say something that's going to become slightly controversial.
Okay.
Jennifer Lawrence is the least interesting part of this film.
I mean, she's reacting again.
Right, so it's I feel like my sister's dog is chewing on something in my room. I don't know where he is. I thought I heard him move. He's a little shithead. But I don't know where he is. Anyways, it's not that she gives a bad performance, but it's, and it fits her character. It totally fits her character. But Rhee is so restrained and kind of emotionally stunted in a lot of ways. I mean, and for obvious reasons. Like I said, it matches the character. But John Hawkes, who plays Teardrop,
yeah,
kind of runs away with this whole film, in my opinion. I don't think he was nominated for it. So, Jennifer Lawrence was nominated for an Oscar, and this was nominated for Best Picture, but I don't know if John Hawkes was nominated for an Oscar. Oh, he was. Good. He didn't win, and I don't know who he lost to, and now I kind of have to look that up. But he definitely deserved his nomination, and Dale Dickey should have been nominated as well. She plays the wife of the big bad of the film.
Yeah, you know what? We never get her name, do we?
I'll look up. I'll look and see if she has a name. Marib.
I'm sure she has a name, but I just never remember them ever saying it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they ever say it out loud either, actually. All right, he lost for Best Supporting Actor to Christian Bale for The Fighter. I mean, I guess I can't be too upset, because that's a pretty good performance. I thought The Fighter was a just okay film, but Christian Bale was definitely great in it. Have you seen The Fighter?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, it's all right. It's the same guy who did the god awful Les Mis movie. And wait, no, it's not.
No, this is the guy that Sivalang's playbook in American Hustle.
Yeah, it's David O. Russell. I was literally looking at Tom Hooper's name when I said that, and Tom Hooper won Best Director that year for The King's Speech, and so wires got crossed in my brain. But yeah, it's the guy who did Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle. Which, out of those films, only American Hustle is really, really good. Not American Hustle. Only Silver Linings is the really great one, in my opinion.
No, yeah. I think Silver Linings is only the rom-com I own.
Oh, see, I don't own it. I wish I did. but I haven't gotten around to buying it yet. It's really fucking good, though.
It's so good.
And it's interesting because I think J-Law is the least interesting of the three big performances in that film, too. I actually think Bradley Cooper does a better job in Silver Linings Playbook than Jennifer Lawrence. And so does Robert De Niro. But, I mean, poor fucking Bradley Cooper that he had to be up against a year where Daniel Day-Lewis was nominated. And it's you know, if Daniel Day-Lewis is nominated, there's like a 75% chance he's going to win.
Was that the year for Lincoln?
Yeah. Okay. I also thought Bradley Cooper was better than Daniel Day-Lewis for Lincoln, if I'm being completely honest. Him and Joaquin Phoenix. Actually, to be completely honest, out of all the Best Actor nominees, I thought Daniel Day-Lewis was maybe the fourth best. So, that was a really absurdly competitive year for that category. Huh. If I'm, like, let me look at that real quick. Yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis for Lincoln, Bradley Cooper for Silver Linings, Joaquin Phoenix for The Master, and then Hugh Jackman, fuck no, for Les Mis, and I haven't seen Flight with Denzel Washington. So, the guy that was in Amour should have been nominated for Best Actor over fucking Daniel Day-Lewis, Jean-Louis Trintignant. But it's rare for foreign language performances to be nominated, although the lady from Amour was nominated that year, but we're getting off topic. The guy who plays Teardrop in Winter's Bone is just a hell of a character actor. And he's on Deadwood. He's the best friend of the lead of Deadwood, who happens to be the lead in Justified as well. And if we ever have time to do that thing that we were talking about, where if we have a week where there's just literally nothing for us to do for this week's Hot Sauce, and we make each other watch an episode of a TV show, I think instead of Justified, I'm going to have you watch that pilot for Deadwood. But it's, he's fantastic. I wish he got, you know, more meaty roles, but he hasn't gotten them. Deborah Granick, the lady who made Winter's Bone, just made a new documentary about a biker who was also a Vietnam veteran and his life dealing with addiction for the last 10 years. And I think that biker that that film is about is one of the people in the film. Oh. Yeah, he definitely is. Okay.
One of the gangsters. I don't want to call them gangsters, but I don't know what else to call them.
Yeah, that's one of the people that works with the well, he works for the big bad guy of the film.
Yeah.
There we go. Oh yeah, he's the big bad guy of the film.
Oh, he is the big bad. Oh, he's
yeah.
What, Murphy? Is that what the guy's called?
Thump.
Like Scott Murphy. I feel like Scott Murphy. I don't know why. Probably wrong.
It's Thump. It's Thump. I don't know where you got Scott Murphy from.
I don't. What is it?
His character's name Thump.
Well, Thump. Well, that's a nickname.
He's Thump Milton. There's Little Arthur. That's another one of the bad guys. But the bad guy's name is Thump Milton.
Milton, not Murphy. Okay.
Yep.
Thump. Okay.
But he is a Vietnam vet and an actual biker, and he's the subject of the documentary that the lady who just made this film just finished, and I think it was nominated for best documentary feature this year at the Academy Awards.
Hmm.
If it wasn't nominated at the Academy Awards, it was definitely nominated for, like, the Golden Globes or something. But, yeah, people, you should watch Winter's Bone. It's great. If you like noir, it's a fun noir. If you're interested in the sociological elements of the film, there's so much of it. Like, there's so much social commentary in Winter's Bone without it ever explicitly being the text of the film. Like, this isn't a message movie, but it has a message. So, yeah, watch Winter's Bone, people. I mean, Trevor, do you have any last thoughts?
Everyone in that movie is super kind at first. Just putting it out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's definitely a southern rural thing, I think. That you're polite until you're not. Basically, I don't have any romanticized vision of the South in my brain because I'm, you know, we're south of the Mason-Dixon line, but we were part of the North during the Civil War. So West Virginia is weirdly both the North and the South in a lot of ways. But I also understand that all the shitty parts about living in the South. But the one thing the South does do well, for the most part, is that sense of politeness to strangers until you become a dick. Until, for whatever reason, you have to not be polite anymore.
Which doesn't take long, so...
It does not necessarily take very long. And on that note, we're going to move on to this week's hot sauce and the 49th Super Bowl. A epic battle between the New England Patriots, who are cheaters, and the, possibly anyways, for deflating balls and for Spygate back in 2007. And then the Seattle Seahawks, owned by one of the richest men in America, Paul Allen, who... is one of the principal owners, or he was, I don't know if he still is, I think he still is one of the principal owners of Microsoft. And Trevor, I'll let you take lead now. What's the setup for this conversation?
Well,
what's
that's
the
a
background?
Good question. Like, I don't know what you've watched, or how much you watched of it. Like, it's one thing to talk
I
about
watched
this
the whole
with Gabe,
because
I know Gabe watched it, and we could just straight up talk about, you know, the play of the night, which is really the only thing to talk about, because that literally 2-inch difference could have made a break of Super Bowl for both teams.
Well, how about the, instead of, I think there were two plays of the night. There was the obvious play of the night, which is the interception by Marcus Butler at the very end of the game. So I watched the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I didn't, I mean, I was playing Pokemon during it.
that's
but
fine.
I also watched.
You can multitask.
I beat Pokemon. I became the champion during the fourth quarter.
Okay, so what's the other play you're talking about? What's the other play talking about?
The catch. That crazy catch where he fumbled it and then caught it on his stomach after he was already on the ground.
Yeah, the cursed catch, which led to the next play. Well, not the next play, it'd be two plays later. But
yeah, it was during the same drive.
Yeah, no, but yes, if the interception didn't happen, then that would have been the play of the game.
Right, if the interception hadn't, yeah, definitely, because the interception is clearly the play of the game, because the Seahawks snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Wait, they snatched victory from the, no, I had this backwards.
The Patriots, you want to go with the Patriots in that statement.
Well, the Patriots snatched victory from the jaws of defeat, but I wanted to make a joke about the Seahawks, where they went from a possible pretty easy win to, oh, we just fucked ourselves over majorly. No. But I don't want to start off with that. Well, I want to, like, lead up to it.
But there is no leading up to it, because the rest of the game was kind of okay. There was nothing particularly great about this game.
I don't know,
game.
For, like, in the first quarter alone, didn't... not Peyton Manning, he doesn't fucking play for either of his teams. Didn't Tom Brady put up kind of crazy numbers in that first quarter?
No.
Oh, I thought he completed
he
like a shit ton of passes.
He had an interception his first drive in the end zone. Keep that in mind.
Hmm?
He had an interception the first drive in the end zone.
Oh, I know. I remember.
Okay, I mean, Tom Brady's performance was solid. He didn't do... He managed that game. That's what irritates me. It was like praising Tom Brady for how great he was in that game. He didn't do anything great. That's the thing. He was just being consistently efficient.
Well, that's been his entire career, I would say.
No, it hasn't. That's what he's been the past few years, because he doesn't have the arm strength or the he doesn't have the arm strength to throw down the field. That's when people don't realize how little Tom Brady throws beyond 20 yards, period. He doesn't do it anymore.
I guess I don't watch football regularly.
Yeah,
so
that's my issue with having this conversation with you, because it's not going to be as informative as it probably should be. But let's go back to the other play, because that's the only thing that can be talked about. Because if that play did not happen, this would be a different storyline, period.
Oh, yeah, the Seahawks would have won.
Yeah, but everyone's upset because they didn't run with it. But if you really think about what happened, the issue with that play wasn't the play call. It was more, well, you could discuss potentially doing something else there. Yes, I can't argue against doing something else, but I can argue against the fact that the play call wasn't particularly wrong. It was the execution of both Wilson and then Lockett, and then the pick on the cornerback right in front, because it was a set wide receiver on their back to back there on the right side of the play, right? And the first receiver's job is to basically block, even though they're not allowed to block at that point. And he got it, but he needs to kind of almost force the direction so the other cornerback behind can't get to the point as quickly. And that didn't happen. And then it wasn't a good break for the wide receiver. And then
Marcus Butler?
Butler. I say, Muffy's stuck in my head for some reason. Butler jumps that route. Like, if he was even like a half a second later, that was not going to happen. And if Russell Wilson would have thrown behind the receiver instead of in front of the receiver, that was never going to be an interception. And the logic behind the play was sound. That's the thing that people don't... So it's second down, 26 seconds, one timeout on the 1 yard line. So you say you do go run, and you don't make it. Now what happens?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. You have to call that timeout, but then you have, you know, however many downs left in the play.
So you have two downs, no timeouts. Do you try running again? And if you don't make it, now you're going to potentially force yourself into a really tight last second hike in order to try to get in the end zone, right?
Right.
So what's the other option instead of running it the next on third down?
Well, I guess what I would argue there is that at that point, do you maybe just accept the fact that instead of having four runs in four downs, you only have the three to do it then?
But if you pass on that second down, you still save your time, and if it's an incomplete pass, right? So outcomes on the pass are incomplete, interception, completion. And if it's so close to the end zone, the completion would have been a touchdown, right?
Right, for sure. If he had made that catch, I mean, the catch was in the end zone, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And he fell out of the end zone, so that's why it was placed on, like, the half-yard line. But, so nevertheless, so you have three outcomes, and two of those outcomes are okay for the situation. The interception was the only one that wasn't okay. It was an incomplete pass. You still have two downs and a timeout. And you could then run twice, and know you can run twice. But if you run first...
I mean, that's fair. It's interesting because isn't... Marshawn Lynch is one of the best running backs in the league, right?
Yeah, no. Like, I understand people's frustration that they didn't run it with him. But they were playing for three downs. Like, we have three opportunities to get this in, and the best chance to use all three opportunities is therefore passing on second down. Because that way they can use their timeout on third down after they run it to potentially run it again. And get the play set up the way they wanted it set up, instead of rushing it.
No, I mean that's totally a fair argument.
And they also got the matchup they wanted on the second down. They had the rookie covering one of their wide receivers, and it was going to be a quick slant. It was all there for them. It was just poorly executed, and it turned out to be an 86%. No, wait. The Seahawks had an 86% chance of winning at that point, and the moment that pass was intercepted became a 0% chance, I think.
Basically.
Yeah. It was one of the greatest spikes in a game ever in terms of win probability.
Right. It's interesting because, I mean, some reporter asked him this question after the game, but can you imagine being Marcus Butler realizing that you pretty much almost single-handedly won the Super Bowl?
Yeah, no, he did. I mean, without that play, they would have lost that game.
That has to feel pretty goddamn good as a rookie, what, linebacker?
No, corner. He was a cornerback.
Corner?
And he's also
cornerback.
Undrafted walk-on, basically.
Wow. Now that is really impressive.
Yeah, so he did not get drafted. He was basically tried out, and they signed him to probably some minimal contract. And there he is, playing in the Super Bowl, making a difference.
Well, here is an interesting question. So Richard Sherman is a safety for the Seahawks, right?
Cornerback, yes.
Okay. You think I would know the difference because safety was the position I played when I played football. But apparently I don't know the difference. Why wasn't he covering Gronkowski?
Thing about the Seahawks defense is they keep it simple and straightforward, and Richard Sherman only plays on the right side of the field.
Okay.
That's his area. If you got a wide receiver on the outside there, he's going to hand him one-on-one the whole time. And also, Gronkowski is huge, so you got a huge height difference between the two and size difference. Gronkowski's like 6'6", like 270. Like, he's a beast. Richard Sherman's big. He's like 6'2", I think, but it's enough of a difference that if you're going to go one-on-one, Tom Brady just has to toss it up there high enough for Gronk to catch it, and there's nothing Richard Sherman can do about it. So,
gotcha.
So,
what was the options? What kind of options did the Seahawks have for covering Gronkowski?
Mostly zone. The few times they didn't play zone, one of those times Gronkowski got a long pass for a touchdown. It wasn't a long pass, but it went for a long. He ran it and scored. And it was the one time they went one-on-one with him with one of the safeties with Chandler. Yeah. But no, so what they do is they'll try to funnel him inside and then use their linebackers and safeties in his own situation to kind of force the pass into a really tight space, which makes it a lot harder to complete the pass.
I was having this conversation with, not this conversation, but I was having a conversation with my roommates before the Super Bowl began because I don't have cable upstairs, so I had to watch the Super Bowl in the living room on their TV. And I was talking about how the fact that football players, out of the big four American sports, and probably out of any of the major sports, football players are handily the most athletic. That the average the average football player has a higher vertical leap than the average NBA player. And that's crazy to me. But it's all because, you know, football is all about leg strength in a lot of ways. You know, you're constantly running up and down the field and being hit by men that are just massive. Neil deGrasse Tyson tweeted a statistic during the football game that blew my mind. And it was that some player for the Red Sox running at 15 miles per hour, hitting a stationary object, hits with more kinetic energy than a bullet from an AK-47.
No, I believe it.
I don't really understand the physics of that. Explain the physics of that to me, Trevor.
Well, that's all dealing with momentum and mass. So a bullet weighs basically nearly nothing, Don. Though it's going really fast and has lots of momentum, its kinetic energy is based off of also its mass. So though it's going really fast, its mass is so small, the amount of energy inside involved in that process is not as much as you think. But it's enough to, you know, puncture. And also the way the bullet shaped helps. With 250-pound guy running at 15, 20 miles an hour, while going a lot slower, he weighs a shit ton more than that bullet does. So that momentum is a lot more with that mass creating more energy.
Okay. Well, then why aren't football players being gibbed when they hit each other then?
Wait, what do you mean?
Like, why aren't we, like, aren't they, like, just fucking destroying each other? Is it just because, like, they're hitting something as equally as big as them?
I mean, your body can withstand it, Don. Remember, what's the action between a bullet and a body are different. A bullet's trying to puncture. It's designed to hit a very small space with a lot of force.
Okay. And if you're hitting with your body, you're hitting a large space.
Yeah.
Okay, like, that makes more sense.
It's still gonna hurt, but you're dispersing the stress in your body because you have so much more surface area getting contacted versus the bullet, which is a tiny little point. So it's all that force going into one location.
Physics, y'all. We just got scientific on the sauce perspective. You know, Trevor has a BS and a master's, so he can explain all this stuff that I don't necessarily understand very well.
I mean, the basic physics is simple. It's beyond the basic physics, but the shit gets weird.
Right. Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, I took physics in high school, but I had it with Mr. Boutwell, and we didn't ever do anything. Mostly, we just had, like, conversations about, like, cosmology. So, like, black holes and the Big Bang and like heat death of the universe and shit like that. Not like the useful stuff that you should have in your introduction to physics course.
Not Newtonian physics. Got it. Yeah.
Right. Well, I wanted to have other things to say about that game.
Well, I mean, we can also talk about Halftime Show or the commercials.
Oh, Halftime Show was terrible. I hated it. Everybody's, like, all into it, but with the exception of Missy Elliott, I thought it was fucking awful. It looked cool, but Katy Perry shouldn't be allowed to sing live. Also, Super Bowl, you know, we broadcast Super Bowl performances like that, and then people wonder why so many kids are on drugs. There are fucking sharks dancing, and one of them couldn't dance at all.
The left shark.
The left shark could not dance at all. Lenny Kravitz showed up to play basically a guitar solo.
Yeah, that was kind of disappointing.
He's headlining a music festival in New Orleans this summer.
Hmm.
The New Orleans Jazz Fest, which is always a pretty big, big thing. I know you like Lenny Kravitz.
I enjoy him, yeah.
Yeah, but I wasn't into it. Also, the commercials were really terrible this year. They were all really dark.
There was a lot more dark ones than normal, that's for sure.
Like the Nationwide commercial?
Yeah.
The one where the kid is dead,
yep.
Which just became fodder for endless jokes on Twitter for the rest of the evening. There was one commercial that I thought was really amazing, though. Like, it was the best commercial of the night, and probably one of the best Super Bowl commercials in a long time, in my opinion. And it was the one with Bryant Gumbel and the news lady.
Oh, the Katie Kirk, yeah.
Yeah, that one was fantastic, where it's like them in the 90s talking about not understanding what the internet is, and then they're basically in magic cars, because that's where we are at with technology now. It's easy to forget because it happens so gradually, but we basically are living in the science fiction future these days. It keeps getting closer and closer. We have, you know, our phones have systems capable of natural language recognition and answering basic questions. It's not artificial intelligence. But we've gotten to the point where we have we have virtual intelligences, that's closer, I suppose, that are capable of understanding natural language queries. That's fucking mind-blowing if you stop and think about it for 5 seconds.
I mean, we do have data pads, basically, now.
Wait, what is it?
Data pads.
The hell's a data pad?
Star Trek reference.
Oh.
The tablets. We have tablets, just like they do in Star Trek.
Oh, okay.
Doors open automatically.
I had no idea what you were talking about. Like, I mean, it's interesting, like, how many things from Star Trek that exist now. You know, sliding doors, touch screens, virtual intelligences, 3D printing. The only shit from Star Wars that basically doesn't exist now is the space traveling parts of it, transporters.
Well, and the
I guess the fact that they've cured all human diseases basically.
Well, that's nice too, but I can't think of what I'm thinking of. The
phaser.
Well, that too. No, that we're probably closer to that than you think.
We probably are.
Don't estimate the military. I'm sure they're doing weird shit that we don't know about.
Oh, I'm 100% positive.
No, so we can't travel at light speed yet. We also can't teleport, and we also can't use, holodeck.
Well, I said transport.
The holodeck. Oh, that's what I was thinking of.
Oh my god, I want a holodeck. Trevor, you're an engineer. Make a holodeck.
Whoa. Stop putting me in a generic engineering terms, please, because that's really offensive. And also,
I know
that
civil
much
engineer. Well, build a bridge version of a holodeck, then. I know that that's complete nonsense, what I just like, said. But there, it's specific to your fucking field.
Bridge holodeck? I'm like, what? I don't even understand. What?
Yeah,
they don't make sense.
It doesn't make any sense. but I want a goddamn holodeck. Well, get one of your other like engineer friends who would be involved in that field and make them do it. Be like, your cousin really wants one, so it's like your responsibility now to tell that to one of your friends.
I'm gonna go find a bunch of computer scientists, a bunch of mechanical engineers, a bunch of electrical engineers. Yeah, fine, we'll figure it out. Yeah,
I guess your field would be the least possible involved in making a holodeck.
Gotta structurally support the holodeck in some capacity, you know.
If it's so big that you have to build a fucking bridge to support it, I guess.
Any structure, right. It doesn't have to be a bridge. I just happen to be only welcome bridges. The math's still
fair
the
enough.
Same, just different concepts of why are we using it.
And on that note, let's end our conversation about the Super Bowl, since we've started talking about Star Trek and holodecks. I really need to finish Next Generation, because I really want to watch Deep Space Nine, because I feel like that's the Star Trek for me. Like, everything that I've read about it makes it seem like that it's the Star Trek that I would be the most interested in.
Probably.
But, just because it's like, it's much more serialized than the other Star Treks in terms of telling a story weekly to weekly. And also, it's really about the politics of the Federation and the Cardassians. And I've never met a Cardassian yet, I don't think, on the show, unless
no,
you count
not at
Kim
your
and
point.
Chloe.
No, it's probably I think season 4 or 5. You probably meet your first one, and the whole conflict on that in that quadrant. Yeah,
right. And doesn't like Wesley end up leaving to join the rebellion or something?
No, not that I remember.
I feel like he does something dumb. I don't know. Wesley
he does
sucks.
Something dumb at the Academy, but that's the whole episode.
Well, I mean, Wesley does something dumb every fucking episode. Except when he'll do something dumb, and then he'll save the day, because he's the worst. Wesley's not the worst. Deanna Troi is the worst. Wesley's a close second. Although, really, only season one Wesley was, like, unbearable. Like, I can't... Like, season one Wesley's one of the worst characters in the history of television. And on that note, Trevor, talk a little bit about The Man in the High Castle.
So this is, I don't know how many people are familiar with the Amazon system of producing shows, but they have a pilot season where they release all their pilots and Prime members can go watch it for free and, you know, rate them and comment on them and, you know, basically give feedback to Amazon, and Amazon will use that feedback in order to determine which series go into full series. And so this one, I heard about this one, so I thought I'd put it on and watch it. It's based in an alternate universe where we lose World War II. And about 2/3 of the country is the Greater Reich. And the other 1/3 is the United Japanese Empire, I think is what they call the West Coast. I forget what they call it. Something about Japanese and the Empire. And so it's setting up... It's basically romanticizing about being the rebellions. So it's several, it's like 2 decades after the World War II ended, and so,
it's like an alternate 60s.
Yeah, I think it was early 60s at this point. Yeah, it actually gave you a date. And so everyone's still functioning, but there's still like tensions, and Hitler is on his last legs of existence. He's chronically ill with something I don't think they actually say. And so on the political level, so they show you on the rebel level and also on the German and Japanese level. And the German-Japanese guys, there's definitely tension there. And I think the Japanese are expecting the German, once Hitler dies, for there to be a conflict again, that Germany will once again try to rise up and, you know, claim the world. But it's also about the rebellions and how it was a cool concept, but the way they did it and the way it was captured, like visually, is really cool, and it looks like they spent a lot of money on this pilot because it's a really well made pilot. But the acting is questionable.
Netflix and Amazon are both spending a shit ton of money on their original content. I think I just read that Netflix wants to borrow $1 billion in long-term debt to finance their original content division.
Wow, that's...
That's a shit ton of money.
Yeah, but here's the issue. Now we're getting all of these shows. What happens is you're flooding the the market with television shows, and what that does is now you're getting worse quality because the acting as the show is, it could be better. And also the direction was questionable. I like the concept a lot. Like, I'll probably, if they make it, I'll probably watch another few episodes just to see where it goes because the concept's really cool to me. But everything else in
this... Yeah, I mean, there's nothing worse than appreciating the concept of something and then, like, loathing the execution of it.
Yeah, and that was my issue afterwards. I'm like, the execution of this was, like, par. Nothing great. It was just, you know, okay, whatever.
No, like, I mean, I totally get that. It's a major irritant for me when I'm enjoying... Like, when all I can think about is, man, like, there's something cool here, but this isn't it. I was just watching something before that I thought basically the same thought. Like, this could be an interesting concept, but what they've done isn't. Now I can't remember.
Probably Black Mirror. You mentioned that about Black Mirror.
Oh, yeah, it is Black Mirror. My memory is going, and if that's the case, I'm just fucked. Because my memory is one of my best qualities. Although that's what happens when you don't sleep enough. You begin to suffer.
Very, very true.
Yeah, sleep is integral to long-term memory formation. Fun, fun, fun. Trevor, don't talk about the plot too much, but how are you enjoying the season premiere of The Americans?
So good, dude. So good. Oh, that comes on tonight? I guess I'm staying up tonight. But so good. God, it comes on at 10 o'clock at night on the East Coast. Ugh, that sucks. But it's so good. So good.
You're such an old man. Oh, man.
I wake up before you go to bed this past week. Every day I wake up and you're still posting on Twitter. I'm like,
I know.
Go to bed, boy.
Yeah, it's getting really out of control now that I don't have Sunday morning shifts anymore. Like, now that I don't ever have to be up, like, even just up by 11:30, it's getting really bad. Although I have a doctor's appointment on Wednesday that I have to be at the place at 8:30. For a doctor's appointment that I've needed for, like, years now. So I'll be up then, and I have to open the bar for somebody the week after that. But I'll be okay, I think. Well, I beat Pokemon X during the Super Bowl. And I realized that I could not catch them all anymore after I had put 30 some hours into the game and then realize that that's how long it takes to just beat the game, and I had only had, you know, 2 gym badges. So I decided, all right, fuck it, I'm gonna beat Pokemon, and I did, and it's really fun. That said, it wasn't as fun when I was just like steaming through this, like steamrolling through the story, because all my characters were so overleveled and nothing was a challenge anymore. That was kind of boring, but it's a fun game. Like, if you play that game the way it's meant to be played, and, like, then go back and catch Pokemon, it's really cool. I enjoyed it a lot. If you've ever played a Pokemon game, but you haven't played one in a long, long time, I recommend checking Pokemon X out. Even if it's for, like, no other reason than to say, man, all these Pokemon are really fucking adorable with, like, this new really powerful graphics engine. They all become, like, way less adorable as they evolve. Like, Blastoise is not nearly as cute as Squirtle. Squirtle, Squirtle. That's what Squirtle sounds like in the anime. Squirtle, Squirtle. He sounds like an old man who's been chain smoking his entire life, and it's really fucking creepy. Squirtle, Squirtle, I need a cigarette. Squirtle.
It's true, it's true.
Like, his voice does not match his body whatsoever. Like, Pikachu's voice matches Pikachu. Pika, Pikachu. And then the Clefairy. From another early episode. Like, anything, like, when they all sound like squeaky and cute like that, that's one thing. But then it's like, Squirtle, Squirtle, I need my I don't know. Whatever you would need if you're an old person. I need my oxygen tank. I haven't watched an episode of the anime in a while, because I started to go back to watching Gilmore Girls, because I need to finish that. And it's been, the fourth season's been okay so far. I feel like that show had a really amazing first season and a really, really amazing second season, but I enjoyed the third season a lot, but it wasn't as good as the first two, and it seemed like the fourth one so far isn't as good as any of the other ones, but we'll see. It hasn't gotten bad yet. Josh Smallwood, and a bunch of other people that I know and whose opinions I respect say that the last two seasons are just terrible, which I've heard. But that's because the showrunner left. It'd be like if Joss Whedon had left Buffy.
Mm.
It would just have just been fucking garbage. Well, Trevor, what was the board game that you played?
So I've played lots of new board games recently, but the one I played last night was called Carvana. Probably never.
How do you
heard
pronounce
it?
Huh? How do you pronounce that again?
Carvana. Yeah, it's cave and Nirvana, like Carvana.
Okay.
Combine those. Yeah. Okay. It's a worker placement game. If you know what that means.
No idea.
Okay. So basically, the objective of worker placement games is to manage the workers you have. It's basically you're running a. Every worker placement game I've ever played is basically you're running a business of some. You're not actually running a business in any of these games, but it feels like you're running a business. So okay. you have your workers, and each worker can do so many actions, and you got to manage how they do those actions, and then manage how to use the resources from those actions to accomplish other things to get you more points.
So it's kind of like, I mean, what I think there is, I think of certain simulation type games where you have a limited amount of time and a limited amount of worker resources, and then you have to optimize the way that you utilize them.
Yeah, that's a worker placement game. Yeah.
Kind of like, I mean, when I think of that, I think of something like the movies.
Okay. Yeah, there's definitely comparisons of how the mechanics work, yeah. Obviously, the themes are so much different here.
Right, for sure.
Themes here is we mine and farm, and we got to sustain our dwarves as we continue doing these items to get more value, and yada, yada, yada. It was different. I really enjoyed it. I didn't know what I was doing at first because, you know, the first time you play a game, you're going to not know exactly any strategy because you don't really know the mechanics or the rules or how to do really anything. But as the game went on, the one guy owned the game, so he's played it before, and he won. Not by much, but he won. And the other three of us, we were all spanking new at this, and it showed. But you just go back and think about how you can start the game again and how to quickly find a way to sustain feeding your dwarves, and then also how to multiply your dwarves. Your dwarves can have babies, so you can get more dwarves and get more actions. Which is a requirement. Like, if you don't do that, you're not going to win the game. The only way you can grow your empire, the only way you can grow a business is by having more people do more work, right? I mean,
right, for sure. Well, the only thing that I have left to contribute to the secret sauce, and we're pretty much running out of time, is that I don't want to have an actual conversation about it because we're going to do it for Digging Deep probably as soon as this whole series is done, so in a couple months. But everybody should watch Boyhood. It's phenomenal. The first half of the movie is not as good as the back half of the movie, but the back half of that film is fucking transcendental. So we're going to be talking about another film from the guy who made Boyhood. As part of this series, we're going to be talking about Dazed and Confused, because it's where like Matthew McConaughey got his start, and to an extent where Ben Affleck got his start. But everybody should watch Boyhood. It's really fucking good. I didn't know if it could live up to its hype, but it definitely did, at least in my book. I'm a fan of the kind of filmmaking that it follows, and some people won't be because it's very episodic and sort of stream of conscious. But like I said, not having a real conversation about it till we discuss it for Digging Deep someday.
Yeah, it's one of three Best Picture nominations I haven't watched yet.
See, I haven't seen most of them. I haven't seen Foxcatcher. I haven't seen Whiplash. I haven't seen Selma. I think the only two that I've seen are Grand Budapest and Boyhood.
And that's two of the ones I haven't seen, so.
Oh, well, you're not missing much with Grand Budapest, at least in my opinion. And I guess on that note, next week, everybody, this was a recent addition because we decided this last week, but we'll be watching Swingers for Digging Deep as the film that launched the careers of Jon Favreau and Vince Vaughn. Specifically, I chose it specifically because Vince Vaughn is going to be one of the leads in True Detective, and this is sort of a great early Vince Vaughn performance. for this week's hot sauce, we'll be talking about the second episode of the Game of Thrones video game, which just came out.
There's a better topic to talk about than that.
What?
Better Call Saul comes out Sunday.
We'll be doing Better Call Saul, and then
because we can play Game
Dead.
Of Thrones whenever, so...
Right, yeah. Better Call Saul, and then The Walking Dead the week after that.
I mean,
because we basically don't have a movie that... Like, there are no movies in theaters that I feel like we have to see until The Avengers.
That's true. That's true. That's the only one that's on
the radar. I was looking at IMDb today, and the wide releases for the next couple months is barren.
Yeah.
Unless we go see 50 Shades, and we're not going to go see 50 Shades of Grey. I'm not going to make Trevor do that.
I would just show up to the podcast and like, oh, hey, Don, no, I didn't watch it, sorry.
it's okay, Trevor. I'm going to make you watch Magic Mike for Digging Deep, so I'll still find a way to mess with you. Because it's actually a really good movie that people only watched because Channing Tatum took most of his clothes off in it. But it's actually a film about the death of the American dream. But... It's okay. I'll find ways to make you uncomfortable. And on that note, Trevor, see us out.
You can always find us on Twitter at SauceSpective. You can also like us on Facebook, as well as, you know, communicate on Facebook with us that way as well. Also can find us on iTunes, where you can subscribe, rate us, and review us, which helps us and also helps people find us. You can also check out the website, thesausagebusiness.com, where you can find the rest of our goodies, from the Sausage and Goal to other editorials that pop up here and there, such as my review of Small World, the board game that I put up yesterday. So, other than that, it's time to...
I guess on that note, have a great week, everybody.
Yep.